Okay, thanks, Mukund, and thank you for the invitation to come to this very interesting place. I'm really sorry I'll only have time to spend just a day and a half here, but I'll try to make the best out of it. So the topic I'll be focusing on is the secretory pathway and how we think about this secretory pathway operation and formation. But before getting into that, I'd actually like to start with a prologue from a previous incarnation of mine when I was a postdoctoral fellow studying mitochondria, actually, which is the subject of last week's session here. And it highlighted for me the perils of evolutionary thinking in cell biology. So that's where I'd like to begin. And so, as most of you know, the idea for the origin of mitochondria is that they are endosymbionts. That is, a billion or 2 years ago, there was an ancient eukaryotic cell with a nucleus, and it engulfed a bacterium, and that bacterium had learned how to make ATP about 20 times more efficiently than the ancestral eukaryotic cell. And so this eukaryote ended up forming a symbiotic relationship with that bacterium, and that bacterium then transformed into modern-day mitochondria. So this is a simplified scheme, of course, but this general idea is very well supported by the evidence that mitochondria are little derived bacteria floating around in our cells. And they still resemble bacteria in many ways. They have their own internal protein synthesis machinery and chromosomes, and they still make ATP like the ancestral, mitochondria still make ATP like the ancestral bacteria. Okay, so most of the proteins of mitochondria are imported from outside the cell. They're synthesized in the cytoplasm, and they're imported into the organelle. And don't pay attention to all the details in this diagram, but the point is that there are four different places that proteins can go when they come into the mitochondria. They can go through both of the membranes. Mitochondria have two membranes, so they can go all the way into the matrix, which is the central compartment, or they can end up in the outer membrane or the inner membrane or the intermembrane space that lies between the two membranes. And a topic that I was interested in as a postdoc was, how do these proteins make it to this intermembrane space compartment? And, well, so first of all, the import all the way into the matrix is in many ways the simplest of these pathways. These two gray lines represent the membranes of the mitochondria, and this is a precursor protein, this green squiggle, and it's made with an extension, an N-terminal pre-sequence or signal sequence that is recognized by the mitochondrial machinery as a signal to take up that protein. So this protein then goes through channels in the outer membrane and the inner membrane to wind up as a mature protein in the matrix. Okay, so that's the pathway for going all the way through both membranes. And this pathway is new in evolution. The ancestral bacterium was not taking up proteins. So in the context of the eukaryotic cell, the mitochondria evolved this mechanism for bringing proteins into the matrix from the cytoplasm. Okay, and by the way, please interrupt me at any point if I gloss over things that are not familiar to people.
Are these channels permanently lined up?
Well, that's part of the issue. No, they're not. They can actually function independently. So it's not a single continuous pore through. It's two channels that functionally line up in tandem.
And then you said it's new for the mitochondria, but it existed in the eukaryotic cell.
Well, no, it's new presumably just in the context of this endosymbiotic event, right? Because the ancestral bacterium made all of its own proteins. And when the endosymbiotic event happened, a lot of those genes ended up migrating to the nucleus, and then the cell needed a way to get those proteins back in. And the cell also put new proteins into the mitochondria, for example, proteins that help to extract that ATP that the mitochondria make.
Are there any proteins now that can get in without machinery?
Can get it. Well, there are still about a dozen or so proteins.
They're nuclear encoded. Is there some passive way to?
Passive way, no. They need some sort of channel to get across the membrane, because a protein will not spontaneously cross the membrane. Yes?
So, 2 weeks ago, there was a mention that these channels are evolutionary related to the bacterial SEEK machinery?
The SEC machinery? No, these are not. So bacteria have a secretory machinery called the SEC machinery that they use to export proteins across the inner membrane. And that's actually what I'm going to come to in just a moment. These are different. These are going the other direction into the mitochondria, and they're not related, as far as I know, to anything that existed in prokaryotes. Okay, so
Ben, they have nothing to do with the translocation machinery in the ER.
No, they're totally different set of components that are specialized for mitochondria. Okay, so the question is, how do you get proteins into this space between the two? And that space is morally equivalent to the outside of the cell if you're thinking of it from the perspective of a bacterium. Right? Bacteria would export proteins across their plasma membrane, and that's equivalent to this intermembrane space of mitochondria. So first of all, there's a signal that's known for getting these proteins to the intermembrane space. And here it is represented schematically. This represents the polypeptide sequence of a protein that's destined for the intermembrane space. So right at the beginning, at the amino terminus, is a sequence that looks just like a typical mitochondrial targeting signal for taking you all the way into the matrix. Okay, but following that is a second signal that contains sorting information for the intermembrane space. Yes?
It's about typical mitochondrial targeting sequence. What is it?
It's actually a typical mitochondrial matrix targeting signal. It's not a specified sequence of amino acids, but it contains, if you represent that sequence as an alpha helix, then one side of the alpha helix will be positively charged and the other side will be hydrophobic. So it's a secondary structural motif that's recognized by receptors on the mitochondrial surface.
And from protein to protein, it's different.
The sequence itself is completely different, but this secondary structure is a common feature of these sequences. Okay, so an intermembrane space targeted protein has a signal that looks just like that, but it has a second signal which contains a hydrophobic sequence. Okay, so it's a two-part targeting signal. So the question is, how do mitochondria decode this two-part targeting signal? And Ulrich Hartl and Walter Neupertz in Munich proposed a mechanism based on evolutionary considerations. So if you just focus down here, it's kind of small, but if you focus here on the right side of the figure, this represents what's going on in bacteria, say the bacteria that are ancestors of mitochondria. In this case, you have a precursor protein with an export signal, a hydrophobic sequence that serves to export the protein across the plasma membrane. So here's the protein starting out in the cytosol. There's an export machinery. This is the SEC machinery. And the protein is exported across the membrane into the extracellular space of bacteria. Okay? The idea that these two researchers proposed is that in mitochondria, you take advantage of that evolutionarily ancient system, and you just add an extra signal that takes you into the matrix. So if you get imported into the matrix, you're right in the same place that you would be in the bacterial cytoplasm. So now you clip off that mitochondrial targeting signal, and now you have a second evolutionarily ancient export signal, and you get exported across the mitochondrial inner membrane, which is analogous to the bacterial plasma membrane, and you wind up in the intermembrane space. Is that idea clear? Okay, so this was a beautiful hypothesis, right? It made perfect sense. You just take advantage of what's already there, you add this other piece to it, and you get proteins into the compartment that they're supposed to be in. And this signal, this secondary signal for sorting in the mitochondria, looks just like a signal for secretion in bacteria. It looks very much like it. So this was known as conservative sorting, because the sorting mechanism has been conserved in evolution according to this model. The only problem with this model is that it's just not true. So,
The great thing is it's falsifiable, okay, which is...
That's the nice thing about cell biology, right? we can actually dissect the mechanisms. So this is a paper that we published, and what I've represented here is this conservative sorting model again, just my diagram of it. So here's a precursor protein with the mitochondrial matrix targeting signal, or matrix-like targeting signal. The black bar is the second sorting signal. The conservative sorting model had that protein going across both membranes and then going back across the inner membrane to the intermembrane space. Jeff Schatz's lab, where I worked, had proposed an alternative model where the protein gets stuck on its way across the inner membrane. This black rectangle now is a stop transfer signal, a signal for arresting translocation. And this gets back to an earlier question. The two channels can then separate, and the rest of the protein just slides across the outer membrane to the intermembrane space. So it never goes all the way in this model. Okay, and this is that, and we presented evidence for this stop transfer mechanism, and it's now the accepted mechanism for this sorting pathway. And one of the nails in the coffin was when the yeast genome sequence was published. It turned out, we analyzed it carefully, and there was no remnant in a eukaryotic cell for the bacterial type sec machinery that should exist in this conservative sorting model. Okay, now this is now where the stop transfer is accepted. This was a very intense debate that went on for many years. The original authors of conservative sorting defended their model with remarkable passion, I would say. And so the lesson to me from this story is, first of all, that evolutionary arguments are very seductive. And it's partly, I think, just because people love to think about things this way. If you sort of imagine yourself at this high vantage point looking across a billion or 2 years of evolution and seeing how all of the pieces fall into place, people love to think in those terms. And you can really make up stories that fit in that kind of a scheme to fit almost every idea that you want. But those kinds of models can be misleading because basically a lot has happened in the past 2 billion years that we don't know about. And I don't know the answer to why mitochondria chose to do it differently, because that conservative sorting mechanism is perfectly reasonable, seems like the simplest, most logical way to solve that problem, and yet somehow that's not how it's done.
Yeah. An argument that the inner membrane of mitochondria is, homologous to the membrane of the
plasma membrane. Well, for example, the ancient bacterium that made ATP had this electron transport chain in its plasma membrane, and mitochondria have exactly the same kind of electron transport chain. So many of the components are there, and conservative sorting is correct in a less interesting sense, and that is that a lot of proteins are imported into the matrix and they assemble into these inner membrane complexes in very much the same way that they would in bacteria. So mitochondria are doing a lot of things the way bacteria do them, but just not this particular pathway. Yeah.
It can be that the old model was like of a mid-step, right? Because the new model that you suggested is more efficient. Basically, instead of bringing it in and then exporting it, it just gets stuck on the way directly to where it should be.
Perhaps. I mean, you can make up a scenario.
I'm just saying,
sure.
You know, that the evolutionary thinking can also lead to the other model.
That's part of my point.
We're here to find out whether this whole subject actually can stand on its own legs or not. So I think one of the major points, for example, that Mike Lynch was saying, to say evolution doesn't just mean I can find a better way to do something, that's probably what happened, is to have an understanding of population genetic forces and understand that bad things can also be fixed, even if they're slightly less efficient and so on. So evolution done by experts, not just by people, you know, who are not trained in some of the more elaborate ingredients of the theory. So this is not an evolutionary hypothesis in that sense.
I guess, and I'm not trying here to say this. You know, say that the whole purpose of this conference is moot. I'm just trying to interject a note of caution, and also to explain where my perspective comes from, in part, as I talk about this. Yeah.
So the protein which is in the outer membrane, how it's called and how it's regulated.
So the proteins in the outer membrane follow a different pathway. It turns out there are multiple different ways to get into mitochondria and to get assembled.
What's the different proteins?
Well, so those proteins, some of them have the same basic structure as bacterial outer membrane proteins. It's more complicated because bacteria also, many of them, have an outer membrane with proteins that have a beta barrel kind of structure, so-called porins. And mitochondria also have porins with a similar structure. So the assembly pathway is probably different, but the basic composition of that membrane is in some ways related.
So meaning that it's, I mean, is this like a huge pore, right?
It's a relatively large pore,
so
that's right.
That means that the membrane has not any potential.
The outer membrane has, I think there's still some debate about that. It can't support a membrane potential like the inner membrane can.
Can that protein can be regulated somehow, be closed or open?
The outer membrane pore, yes. There is also regulation of this pore. The inner membrane is much tighter. It's tight. It has a proton electrochemical gradient.
Okay.
So it's, the two membranes are very different. And I've been talking really just about what's happening in the inner membrane.
Are there endosymbionts that have the sac machinery?
Actually, yes. So chloroplasts, which I skipped over, have a second membrane, the thylakoid membrane that's inside, and there are proteins that actually go across the two outer membranes and then follow a conservative sorting pathway into the chloroplast. And here they have to. There's no, because of the topology, there's no other way for it to work, and it does use machinery of that type. So it's not that the idea was, you know, was in any way off target. It's just it didn't happen to be the way it works in mitochondria.
But that would mean the mitochondria loses the entire
presumably. And so you could, I think that there was an example of so mitochondria are very different in different eukaryotes, and there was one where there was some remnant of the SEC machinery. It was certainly there originally, and it may have been preserved in some lineages, right? So, anyway, so again, I'm not trying to throw out evolutionary thinking exclusively, but my personal take on it is that the major power of evolutionary thinking is what I think in the talk we heard was called comparative biology, and that is to look at different modern day species that do things differently and to view them from the perspective of organisms that have diverged from a common ancestor. And I'll come back to that in the rest of my talk. So the focus of the research in my lab is the Golgi apparatus, which was discovered by Camillo Golgi in 1898. And this has been an interesting subject, partially because it was and is controversial. So this is my favorite quote about the Golgi apparatus. No cellular organelle has been the subject of as many as long-lasting or as diverse polemics as the Golgi. So it attracts all kinds of somewhat off-kilter people who battle with each other. So this is just an example of what Golgi originally saw. This is his drawing from light microscopy of an internal reticulum that was stained by a particular staining method that he developed. And I'll skip over the first 50 years of this debate and just show you what electron microscopy revealed when that was introduced into biology in the 1950s and 60s. So the Golgi apparatus in different organisms typically looks like this. It's a stack of flattened membrane disks that are called cisternae. So it looks like a stack of pancakes. And what you're looking at here on the left is a cross-section, a little thin slice through two of these Golgi stacks in an alga called Chlamydomonas. So each of these Golgi stacks here has about 7 or 8 cisternae. On the right is a 90-degree rotation. Here you're looking down on one of these cisternae. And you can see that it's basically disc-shaped in structure. And at the rims of the cisterna are small membrane vesicles that are budding or fusing with the edges of the cisterna. Okay, so again, stop me if there are questions about this. This is traditional electron microscopy analysis of what the Golgi looks like. And Chlamydomonas is often used because it has a very beautiful textbook Golgi structure. The structure of the Golgi varies considerably in different organisms, and in mammalian cells, the Golgi apparatus is more elaborate. So this is sort of a semi-3D image of the Golgi region in a mammalian cell. Each of these structures labeled G is one of those Golgi stacks. But in a mammalian cell, there are about 100 Golgi stacks near the nucleus, and they're all connected to each other by tubules that snake out from the rims of those cisternae and connect all of those stacks together into a continuous ribbon. Okay, so the same basic structure, but topologically more complex in mammalian cells.
Where's the nucleus here?
The nucleus, I'm not sure if it's visible here. This is a close-up. It would be.
The operation of Golgi near the nucleus is not something that we see. That we're supposed to observe in this picture?
In this picture, you're just looking at the Golgi region. And I don't know, Alberto, maybe you can, you have any idea? The nucleus may be down here. It's typically right next to the nucleus. So this is a close-up of just a part of the cell.
So what is this sort of boundary that's black region?
I don't actually know. This is a somewhat unusual electron microscopy method that this group used, and I like this picture, but I'm not familiar with the details of that method, so that it could be an artifact of the way it was preserved. So one thing that's common to these Golgi stacks in all organisms that have been examined is that they're polarized. That is, the cisternae on one side of the stack are biochemically different from those on the other side. And the two sides of the Golgi stack are known as cis and trans. If you look at the bottom, you'll see this is actually a variant of Golgi's original stain. And you'll see that only the cisternae at the cis side of the Golgi are labeled by this stain. So this is what he was actually seeing by electron microscopy. Here's a different staining method that labels only the trans cisternae. So these are not very well defined staining methods. The basic point here is that the Golgi stack is polarized. The different sides of the Golgi are biochemically distinct. Okay, so the functions of the Golgi are very well understood. The first function is in processing of cargo proteins. Newly synthesized proteins that are going to be secreted from the cell are first delivered to the endoplasmic reticulum. From there, they move through the Golgi stack on their way out to their final destinations. As these proteins move through the Golgi, carbohydrate side chains are modified extensively. So the Golgi has been called a carbohydrate factory. And here the details are not important, but this is just an illustration of material coming in from the endoplasmic reticulum. It first encounters the cis side of the Golgi. And this little blue guy is part of the polypeptide chain. There are elaborate carbohydrates that are trimmed down and then built back up as the protein moves through the Golgi stack. Okay, so it's a processing, sort of a finishing station for these newly synthesized proteins. The other main function of the Golgi is protein sorting. At the exit face of the Golgi, which is known as the Trans-Golgi Network, or TGN, these different classes of newly synthesized cargo molecules are segregated and are packaged into different carriers that take them to their final destinations. So some of these proteins are going out to the cell surface to be dumped into the outside world, but others are going to other intracellular compartments, such as endosomes and lysosomes. Okay, and that sorting reaction happens at the Trans-Golgi Network. Okay, so here's just a crude diagram of that process. This idea came together about 25 years ago, that all of these proteins move through the Golgi, through the cis, medial, and trans parts of the Golgi, and then at the TGN, they're segregated into these different carriers, and they go off to their final destinations. Okay, so that's a very quick summary of the background. And from the point of view of what I'll be telling you about now, I think it's very useful to distinguish different features of the secretory pathway. And I put these features into two main categories. One category is features that are highly conserved between different eukaryotic cells. So, for example, all eukaryotic cells seem to have the same basic structural organization of the Golgi. It's a series of distinct compartments, and these processing steps, these sequential processing steps, occur in different compartments, followed by a sorting step at the Trans-Golgi Network. So this is a textbook image of what happens in the mammalian Golgi apparatus. In the Golgi apparatus from the budding yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the details of these carbohydrate modifications are completely different. But the basic principles are the same. Material arrives from the ER, undergoes a series of sequential modifications in these different compartments until it reaches a trans-Golgi network where the sorting event occurs. Okay, so the basic organization of the Golgi is a conserved process. You're looking puzzled. Yeah.
Well, you said that biochemical steps are completely different.
That's right.
So I guess how completely
not.
Going further back, so an ignorant question, like do prokaryotes attach sugars to their polypeptides?
Not. I could be wrong about this. At least until recently, the idea was that this was a uniquely eukaryotic pathway. There are, I did talk to someone who said that there are
glycoproteins and
that there's evidence for something related to this in prokaryotes. Does someone else know more about that than I do? Have you? It's much. If so, it's much less well, much less well described.
How is the cell wall synthesized in bacteria?
So that there are different pathways for cell wall synthesis, but it's not. There's nothing closely analogous to what goes on in mitochondria, in the Golgi apparatus.
Is, there is no structure such as Golgi.
That's
but
right.
What is? But is there related by chemistry?
Not closely related to this. So I exaggerated a bit when I said that there's no similarity. So at the level of the endoplasmic reticulum, the original oligosaccharide that's added is the same in most or all eukaryotes. But the subsequent processing steps are very different. In yeast cells, it's only mannose residues added in different chemical linkages, and you can sometimes get very long chains of these mannoses. In mammalian cells, you have addition of additional sugars, N-acetylglucosamine, galactose, and sialic acid, and so on. So the structures that are built, these oligosaccharides that are built from the common core, end up being very different in the two yeast, in the two organisms.
Is there a biochemical reason why whatever is added in the medial cistern, the biochemistry of the medial cistern cannot be done in the cyst cistern?
That's a really good question. So this, and it's actually one of the embarrassingly open questions in the Golgi field, why do you have a series of distinct compartments in the first place? Because, well, you could argue that you need to segregate these enzymes to keep the chemistry working. But there are many other examples in the cell where the product of one reaction is the substrate for the next, and there's no need to segregate them physically. And so I think that, for the most part, that explanation doesn't really hold for the separation of these compartments. My personal feeling is that the Golgi is basically a factory, and you need to move through these different steps in the assembly line. And by segregating it into different compartments where a protein has to go all the way through, you ensure that the protein stays in the factory long enough to get completed. Whereas if everything were just mixed together, then as soon as a protein came in, it could leave again. So that's kind of a fuzzy explanation, but that's, for me, the best that we have.
Well, I guess from the evolutionary point of view, I was fishing for some eukaryotic superiority view argument that perhaps prokaryotes have their glycoprotein biochemistry limited to maybe the first step, mm-hmm. and they do not use this, or they do not have the compartmentalized factory structure that would allow them to go further. But
I think there's something to that.
Evolution actually, maybe they're not as underdeveloped as us eukaryotes want to think, and. Maybe they just found another way of carrying out equally complex biochemistry.
I think there is. Eukaryotes can do some things that are more complex, and this was actually mentioned by Jennifer Lippincott-Schwartz in the video we just saw. So in prokaryotic cells, the only option is to secrete across the plasma membrane. And you can do some oxidative chemistry there. But there is no ATP out there. It's hard to do much more in the way of assembly. In the eukaryotic endomembrane system, which is just a term for the ER and the Golgi and so on, you have an internal compartment where you can control the chemistry and the reactions much more. You can provide ATP, which is present in the ER. And eukaryotes do tend to assemble much more complicated structures, sometimes requiring a long time to do it. And then with these additional compartments, you can get additional refinements and sorting reactions that occur. So I think there's no question that the increased complexity of the eukaryotic cell gives more options than are available in prokaryotes.
So actually, issue is the construction of the cell wall in a prokaryote.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's incredibly complex chemistry goes on to build the cell wall, mm-hmm. carbohydrates, sugars, and lipids. And in the eukaryote, in the absence of a cell wall, this is the only way you can produce sugars on the outside of the cell.
That's right.
And so, you know, in some ways, I think the construction of the cell wall in a prokaryote and the construction of the glycocalyx of the eukaryotic cell are probably analogous in terms of what the cell is going to be visualized as from the outside.
The eukaryote has the luxury of sort of prefabricating big parts of these structures and then delivering them to the outside.
It's almost as if that entire, you know, presentation is now being manufactured inside.
That's right.
The protein. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it known how the sorting process works?
There's a lot known about this sorting that occurs at the TGN. Certainly not completely understood. And I think it would be too long a digression to go into that, but there are some specific signals that are known and receptors in certain cases. Okay, so...
Sorry,
yes?
Are there mutants where you can exchange the chemistry, which the things they're doing in medial, you can start doing it, and cis, and the proteins get these oligoproteins, glycoproteins get completely messed up? Or?
Sure, there are mutants that... Certainly in yeast and also in mammalian cells that will perturb this organization and alter the glycosylation. You can even engineer, people have taken some yeasts and re-engineered them to do this mammalian type oligosaccharide processing for therapeutic purposes to make proteins that look human-like that are synthesized in a yeast. And the system is fairly flexible. You can perturb it quite a bit, at least in something like a yeast, and it still basically works. So you don't need this perfectly refined organization. Okay. So I was just talking about a conserved feature, something that's universal, or probably universal. There are other features of the secretory pathway that are clearly not conserved. And I already mentioned one example, and that is that in a mammalian cell, the Golgi forms a ribbon near the nucleus. So here's a diagram of that. These purple structures are Golgi stacks. And in mammalian cells, the Golgi membranes run along a cytoskeleton made out of microtubules, and they all converge on the center of the cell where they get linked together to form this Golgi ribbon. But that's not seen in other cell types. For example, in higher plant cells, there are, again, many Golgi stacks, these little purple guys, but they're all over the cell, and they're individual stacks. They're not linked together. And they interact with the actin cytoskeleton rather than the microtubule cytoskeleton. Okay, so this is a cell type specific at elaboration of the basic Golgi machinery. And that doesn't mean that it's unimportant, right? This kind of organization is obviously doing something valuable for these particular cell types, and it's worth studying and understanding. But I think it's useful to keep this comparative view in mind, because the mechanisms that are involved here are likely to be specific to those cell types and not fundamental conserved mechanisms for the operation of the organelle. For example, if you're thinking about how the Golgi works and you invoke a ribbon structure or microtubules as part of that basic mechanism, you're probably on the wrong track, because that's only something that happens only in mammalian cells. Okay?
Yeah. Might it be interesting to look at this structure in mammalian cells during cell division?
Oh, it's interesting, and that's been the subject of a lot of research and a lot of controversy. Yes, so it breaks down and reforms, and well, that's another whole story.
What does it look like in yeast? Is it the mammalian type or the?
I'll come to that in just a moment. Yeah. Okay, so I mentioned that the Golgi is controversial, and probably the most controversial aspect of this system has been a very simple question. How does secretory cargo traverse the Golgi? So material arrives at the cis side of the Golgi stack from the ER, and it departs from the trans-Golgi network, but what happens in between? How does it move through this Golgi stack? And when I was growing up in the field, this was the most popular view of how the Golgi works. So these little things that look like razor stubble represent secretory proteins that have just been made in the endoplasmic reticulum and that are on their way through the Golgi stack, eventually to be released to the outside world. Okay, so the idea was that membrane vesicles, these little spherical packages of membrane, carry material from the endoplasmic reticulum to the cis Golgi, and then from one cisterna of the Golgi stack to the next. So a little vesicle grabs you and takes you from one processing station in this factory to the next. Okay? And the idea is that these cisternae, these compartments, are stable, long-lived processing stations in the Golgi factory. Now, and these vesicles that are thought to carry material between the cisternae are known as COP1 vesicles, that standing for coat protein 1. Okay, so those vesicles have been identified. The stable compartments model ran into a number of problems, and I'll just highlight maybe the major problem, and that is that sometimes the Golgi makes big secretory cargos, and those cargos can be larger than a COP1 vesicle. So it's hard to understand how something that big gets carried in one of these little vesicles. And here's an example. This, again, is from an algal cell, and we're looking down on a Golgi cisterna. So here's the outline of this disc, this Golgi cisterna. And here are the COP1 vesicles right here around the edges. Now, the cargo that's going to be carried forward includes these dark things, but also these long structures that are scales that are going to be deposited on the surface. And I think it doesn't take a physicist to see that this structure is not going to fit in that vesicle. All right, so somehow that mechanism doesn't allow or doesn't explain how big things move through the Golgi. These are called scales. So this is an example of what we were just talking about, that eukaryotes build components that are going to wind up on their cell surface. And these are structures that are going to form part of the outer surface of the algal cell. So they're constructed and elaborated within the Golgi and then delivered to the cell surface where they're put into place. Okay, so I think the structure is not known in detail, but it's a combination of protein and carbohydrate material.
You can't fold it.
Pardon me?
You can't fold it up.
Well, this is the structure that it assumes. It's stable three-dimensional structure. Oh, so you're saying you can't wrap this thing up and put it into a vesicle? Yeah. Well, it depends how motivated you are to support that model. Right, it looks unlikely, but... Okay, so there was an alternative model that actually has been discussed in the literature for many years called the cisternal progression model. And the view here is that the Golgi is basically a conveyor belt, that membranes coming out of the endoplasmic reticulum coalesce to form a new cisterna at the cis face of the Golgi. And this entire cisterna would then chug along through the Golgi stack, carrying the secretory cargo with it. And eventually, at the trans side of the Golgi, this cisterna would fragment into the different kinds of carriers and would disappear. Okay, so this model very nicely explains how big things can move through the Golgi. They progress through by being carried within the cisterna themselves, not within vesicles. And an example would be the algal scales that I just talked about. But it's not just algae that move big things through the Golgi. And this is an image from a paper published by Alberto Luini, whom you'll be hearing from tomorrow. And the black material is procollagen, which is a component of our bodies. And it's made in these skin cells. And you can see these big black structures, these large aggregates of procollagen within the Golgi. And here, for a comparison, is a COP1 vesicle that's forming. So again, these structures are much bigger than the vesicles. And Alberto's group showed very convincingly that procollagen moves through the Golgi stack by cisternal progression. That is, that doesn't go into vesicles. The entire cisternae, this material is remaining within the cisternae as they move from the cis to the trans side of the Golgi.
But isn't the question then why you need these different discs? Because before you talked about that the biochemics is different in each disc.
It is different.
You're saying that it's one disc that moves through.
Okay, so you're
contradicting that.
Asking exactly the right question, because this
could be, of course, yeah.
This is the reason it's been so difficult to make sense of this field, because you have, on the one hand, you have these biochemical differences with early acting enzymes on the cis side and late acting enzymes on the trans side. And on the other hand, you have this evidence that the whole thing's a conveyor belt. So how does that fit together? And I'll come back to that in just a second. So from what I just showed you, or from what I've showed you so far, the Golgi is polarized. Early acting proteins live on the cis side of the Golgi, represented here in green, and late acting proteins live on the trans side, represented in red. And yet, according to this morphological evidence, these early cisternae carrying something big like procollagen, shown here in black, this early green cisterna will eventually move through the stack and become a late red cisterna. Yeah.
What is eventually? A day or an hour?
5 minutes, 10 minutes.
10 minutes.
Yeah. Turning over fast. Okay. So somehow we have to reconcile these observations. And a way to reconcile it is a model called the cisternal maturation model, which I've highlighted here because it's my personal favorite view of how the Golgi works. So the idea is that it basically is an elaboration on the cisternal progression mechanism that I just described. The idea is that vesicles carry material out of the ER, but these vesicles coalesce with each other to make a new cisterna at the cis face of the Golgi stack. And this cis cisterna migrates through the stack, carrying the secretory material with it, and the cisterna then fragments and disappears at the trans side. So meanwhile, there's another class of vesicles, these COP1 vesicles that I showed you that are clearly there doing something. But in this model, the COP1 vesicles are not carrying the secretory cargo forward. Instead, they are recycling the resident components of the Golgi and keeping them within the Golgi stack. So as the cisterna moves forward, it exports its one set of Golgi enzymes to a younger cisterna, while receiving another set of Golgi enzymes from an older cisterna. So the cisterna gradually evolves or matures in its biochemical composition while carrying the secretory cargo forward. Okay, so this model can explain how big things move forward, and it can explain how you maintain a polarized Golgi stack even while this conveyor belt is running. Yes?
So I've always thought these two models sound completely the same, because if you just switch resize plasma membrane ER and exchange cargo for enzymes, it looks like, if you just flip this picture around, it's what you showed us a few slides ago. More or less correct?
So this cisternal progression is, this encapsulates part of the model, but it doesn't have a role for the vesicles. You notice there are no vesicles drawn in this diagram.
No, not this one. I'm talking about stable
compartments. Stable compartments. Yes.
Fine. So to some extent, you've got the vesicles moving in the other direction.
That's right.
The plasma membrane ER flipped. And in some sense, you have creation and destruction of entire cisternae in one case and not in the other.
That's right.
So the key is that in the maturation model, a new cisternum can be formed de novo.
That's right. That's correct. So one analogy that's that I sometimes use is, if you imagine the Golgi stack as being like an escalator, where the cisternae are the steps of the escalator. So you see them forming and moving through and disappearing at the other end. And imagine people on the escalator walking down at exactly the same speed that the steps are moving up. The system is always turning over. Everything in the system is moving. But if you take a snapshot at any given time point, it always looks about the same. So that captures the essence of this view.
Yeah. But if you were to quantitatively model this, both these things could come about by a small change of some kinetic parameter.
What do you mean, both of these things? Both of what things?
Maturation, yes. You can have an oscillatory solution, you can have stable solutions with one parameter that could move from one to the other.
This thing is like co-moving, and cargo stays in the cistern. I mean,
what do you call cargo? What I call enzymes. But I'm just saying that.
That's clear, right? The enzymes presumably do not cycle, but the cargo is in flux.
So I can imagine changing some of the fusion rates and fission rates and some of the chemical rules, and you move smoothly from one model to the other. These are not fundamentally distinct models.
Perhaps, but to explain how. Well, I think they are fundamentally distinct because it views the cisterna either as a structure that persists.
Yeah, there was this talk by, I forgot his name, an experimentalist, and he actually tagged things and showed clearly that this is what's happening and not, and you don't have a space.
Was Aki here earlier?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So some of you heard part of this. I'll show you.
I think that was the way to distinguish between the two, possibly.
I'll get to that in just a sec.
Not saying you can't distinguish what's going on. I'm just saying that the same, you can write down a bunch of equations which in two different regimes would produce these two, the same equations would produce these two different behaviors.
I'm not sure I understand that, but I'd love to discuss it.
The point is that the same equations can also produce anything in between.
Sure. Right, you can have both cargo moving from one compartment to another and enzymes moving from compartment to another. But the interesting thing is that it's either one limit or the other. So the fact that you can move from one limit to the other through all sorts of observed intermediate things is not terribly.
So in some sense, the observation I'm trying to explain with these equations is not so much how the Golgi works, but why the field is so confused.
Hmm. Well,
because it's not that clear. It's not that clear.
Well, I mean, to sort of branch off into the philosophy of this for just a second, I think one of the reasons this model has been a bit difficult to embrace is that cell biologists think of the cell as being a machine. And our goal is to try to identify the components of the machine, where they are, what they do, which components interact with which other components. But the limitation of that analogy is that human-built machines tend to have stable, well-defined components. And the engineering logic of the cell may not be the same. These are components that are forming, transforming, and disappearing. And it's just hard to understand how that kind of system works because we're just not used to that that approach. Yeah.
I have a very naive question. So where do the trans proteins come from?
Well, they are initially all made in the endoplasmic reticulum, and they come through and then they sort of get trapped and reused.
Which protein? Enzymes are being transferred from the trans site to the cis site, right?
Yes.
In the process of maturation.
Oh,
so where do the trans enzymes come from?
Well, they are being recycled in pathways that are not shown on this diagram. So there are downstream pathways, and then they come back in this recycling vesicle here.
Where does the spatial dimension fit into the? Does it matter? So you can have this model regardless of whether they're dispersed or
absolutely.
And so on.
That's right. It's drawn this way just for convenience, but there's no intrinsic reason to have them piled up in an ordered stack like this. And that will be important in just a moment when I come on. Yeah, yeah.
Why did the COP1 vesicles like to go in one direction instead of, I mean, how do they target the...
So this has been, so a central prediction of the cisternal maturation model is that COP1 vesicles are moving backwards and they're carrying resident Golgi enzymes and recycling them. The stable compartments model makes the opposite prediction. The COP1 vesicles are moving forward and are carrying secretory cargo. And it seems like a straightforward way to distinguish between the two. But there's been a lot of work trying to find, look for the components of COP1 vesicles, and people have come to divergent conclusions. In fact, Alberto's lab is one who has one group who has looked at this, and they have not found the expected concentration of resident Golgi enzymes in COP1 vesicles. Other groups have found evidence for that. So at the moment, I would say that's really up in the air. Yes?
Is it correct that this model is saying that the COP1 vesicles are only going to the ER if they're in the cis side?
Presumably, yes.
So how does the COP1 vesicle know not to go to the ER if it's in the trans?
That's another question. So these vesicles, vesicles have targeting factors that are captured as the vesicles are made. And those are recognized by complementary components on the target compartment. And so the presumption is that these vesicles have a built-in address system when they're made that tells them where to go. But that also is still not understood in detail how that might work. Yes?
Has there been any evidence of vesicles testing out raw? Well, I guess you couldn't see it. Could you see it if a vesicle were testing out a wrong target compartment and then said, oh no, this is the wrong guy, I'll keep on
That's been hard to do. You can see these vesicles by electron microscopy. And as someone pointed out, they don't come with little arrows on them when you see them there, right? So if you want to track them, their actual motion, you have to do it by fluorescence imaging. And that currently doesn't have the resolution, the temporal and spatial resolution to really track them.
Can one see the wrong enzyme in the, can one see a trans enzyme here in the system part?
Well, the thing is that, so I showed you this earlier diagram, this earlier image of staining. It looks here like the trans cisternae and the cis cisternae are completely different, right? You get all the staining in on one side or the other with this old stain. If you actually look at that in more detail, look at these resident components, they're not cleanly segregated into early or late cisternae. They actually form a concentration gradient or a distribution across the cisterna. And so a protein that lives at steady state in the trans Golgi and is concentrated there will actually visit the cis Golgi at high frequency and vice versa. So again, the system, it's a little bit hard to wrap your head around it because it's more a stochastic separation than a clean one.
Going back to our sort of previous discussion of whether one really needed to have a clean segregation.
That's right.
In order to do biochemistry, and if the answer to that is no, then
that's right.
All these cis and trans labels are something that we attach to the cisterna, but not the...
That's right. You can imagine as a protein is moving through that it will be more efficient from the chemistry to have the early acting enzymes concentrated early and the late ones concentrated late. But you're right, there's no need to segregate them cleanly. They don't have to be cleanly segregated. That's right. Yeah.
So I guess the endoplasmatic reticulum in this picture could form this Golgi apparatus at any point, and probably there's some signaling molecule also involved. So maybe that could be an interesting. One had an idea about the signaling molecule is to like induce that at a given position and see where there's no Golgi apparatus.
This side.
And see whether that.
That's a good point too, which I'll get to. I'll get to that idea too.
Yeah. I guess in a way already what has been said is that when we look at the snapshot picture, we see, let's say, okay, here four different color-coded compartments and we give them separate names.
Right.
But you've already said that this is actually a continuum labeled by time.
Right.
So we shouldn't really give them names.
So that's true from what I've just told you. In this scheme, a trans cisterna is just an older cis cisterna, and they're along a continuum. So whether it's really a continuum is another question. And I think, this is sort of jumping ahead a bit, but I think that there may actually be, that the maturation process may actually be kinetically discrete. That is, that a cis cisterna has cis character for a while, And then there's a there's some kind of positive feedback loop that builds up and crosses a threshold. And then that cis cisterna dumps its cis components and receives later components in a more or less quantized way and undergoes a transition to a medial cisterna. So these compartment names may actually have a meaning in that sense, in that kinetic sense. But that's just speculation. Move ahead. So, okay, this will address some of the other questions that were raised. So experimentally, our group focuses on budding yeasts as a system for addressing some of these fundamental questions. And we work with a pair of budding yeasts. So they're closely related, relatively speaking. That is, they look very similar. They diverged not that long ago in evolution. But their secretory pathways look quite different, at least superficially. So drawn on the left here is a budding yeast called Pichia pastoris. Blue is the nucleus, and white is the endoplasmic reticulum, which consists of the nuclear envelope plus additional membranes that run through the cell. Okay, and Pichia pastoris also has very nice-looking Golgi stacks of the type that I've been showing you. Now, these Golgi stacks are sitting right next to specialized regions of the endoplasmic reticulum that are known as transitional ER sites or ER exit sites. And those are regions of the ER where vesicles are budding to carry material to the Golgi. So the ER is a continuous membrane network, but it has functional and biochemical specializations, including these transitional ER sites. Okay, so in Pichia, you see a Golgi stack always sitting next to a transitional ER site. And that's true also in many other eukaryotes. Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is very well studied, much, much more intensively studied, actually has a really weird-looking Golgi. It has a functional Golgi of the type that I've described, with discrete compartments that carry out sequential processing. But the individual cisternae are not organized into stacks. They're separated, scattered throughout the cell. And that addresses the earlier question that, yes, the basic model for Golgi operation doesn't necessarily invoke this stacking process. Saccharomyces also has a lot of little transitional ER sites instead of a few big ones. And it turns out that these two yeasts are, well, for one thing, it's very interesting to compare them, but they have complementary advantages for studying the secretory pathway. And I guess so, someone said that Aki Nakano was here recently. He was a visitor. Okay, so some of you will have heard this in different forms, so I won't spend too much time on it. But in most cells, when the Golgi is stacked, you see that at the level of light microscopy, it's impossible currently to distinguish, to resolve those individual Golgi cisternae. In Saccharomyces, with this scattered Golgi, the individual cisternae appear as discrete spots. And so they can be tracked by fluorescence microscopy. So here's an animation of the ideas that I've been talking about. The black dots represent a secretory cargo that's come from the endoplasmic reticulum. And the idea is that and green here represents an early Golgi component, a protein that lives and works in the early Golgi. Red represents a protein that resides in the late Golgi. So the idea is that a cisterna is green for a while, but it exports its early Golgi proteins to younger cisternae while receiving late Golgi proteins from older cisternae. So in this scheme, the protein changes color, the cisterna changes color over time. The alternative stable compartments model proposes that these cisternae are long-lived structures with vesicles carrying material from one cisterna to the next. Okay, so to distinguish between these two, we can imagine putting a green fluorescent protein on an early Golgi enzyme to label the early Golgi green, and a red fluorescent protein on a late Golgi protein to label those cisternae red. And then we can track them over time. So this is the first frame of a projected movie, 3D images over time, where green spots are early Golgi cisternae and red spots are late Golgi cisternae. And you'll see right away that this was a technically challenging task because there are a lot of cisternae and they're moving around. And in this projected image, you can't really see if they're going through each other or over or under each other. But again, we have the 3D data set, so we can go back and focus in on individual cisternae and make simplified movies. And here we see very clearly that a cisterna glows green for a couple of minutes, undergoes a rapid transition, then glows red for a couple of minutes before losing all of its fluorescence. And we see this quite consistently. It's always a green to red transition. And the time course is similar. It's always about 2 to 3 minutes for each of these stages. So these results are quantified here, showing that as the early marker goes down, the late marker comes up, and so on. So this is similar to what Aki Nakano presented. He did this work independently and arrived at similar conclusions. And we think that this is direct evidence for cisternal maturation. We're seeing it, you know, very, very directly. And I think most people in the field have accepted that interpretation of these observations. Okay.
So where does the green go and the red come from?
So it's back to this scheme. So the idea is that there's a certain amount of the green protein around, but as a cisterna matures, and again, I'm showing this as happening continuously, it might be more discrete, but as the cisterna matures, it exports its green. In some cases, that would be within vesicles, and you don't see those little vesicles. They're too small and moving too fast to see in this with this method. But then they wind up being captured by another early cisterna, which then starts to glow green. So the components are cycling on this time scale. This is a time scale of a few minutes. They're cycling around between these maturing compartments. Yes.
It seems like the real test of the theory would be if you can see one green cisterna going red and simultaneously another red one disappearing.
So we've looked at that, and it's not obvious that they're synchronized in that way. So we've looked in a mutant where there are just a few big cisternae in the cell, and you can see all of them undergoing these transitions, but we don't see a linkage between the different cisternae, not so far.
Why would you expect the number of cisternae to be conserved like that? It's the number of red enzymes that you might think should be.
Well, because the red enzymes in the bottom green cisternae came presumably from the upper red cisternae.
But it's not the number, right, of cisternae, it's the number of enzymes.
Yeah. You can have cisternae of different sizes, so we don't necessarily look for a conservation at that level. Yeah.
It's also Saccharomyces cerevisiae, right?
This is all Saccharomyces, what I've showed you so far. Yes.
So how does the lifetime of this enzyme compare to...
Much longer, so that at a couple of orders of magnitude longer. So hours, at least hours, and this was on a time scale of a couple of minutes.
What did you fluorescently label? Was it the cargo or the enzyme?
This is the enzymes, the resident Golgi proteins. We're trying hard to fluorescently label a cargo. The prediction is that that cargo should sort of passively get carried along while the enzymes come and go. The cargo is, well, it's actually heterogeneous, but the idea is that the cargo is just sort of going along for the ride.
How do you mean the cargo is the same and the enzyme is different?
Yes, well, the idea is that the cargo is the same as the cisterna matures. The cargo just sits there and gets processed as these different...
I think you claim that you would need a marker for the cargo.
How do you know if the cargo is unchangeable? Can you label the cargo?
Well, we're trying. It turns out in mammalian cells there is a cargo that you can use, and they just, for technical reasons, hasn't been there in Saccharomyces. And we're trying now to make a cargo that we can label in a third color so that we can do three-color imaging and test the next level.
The cargo is the same and different
enzyme. Oh, so you can... Oh, that's okay. I think I understand your question. So if you just see the cisterna glowing, say, in a third color, how do you know that it's the same molecules that have been there?
Sure.
Well, we don't know that just by this kind of observation, but you can do photobleach recovery. So if you bleach a cisterna, say if we could bleach these cargo molecules, you can then ask, does the signal recover during the lifetime of the cisterna? If it doesn't, that says that the unbleached ones just stay there and go on. If it does recover, you can say that they're exchanging, and that's something we don't know yet. We want to test.
So if you have fluorescent cargo, and if you have fluorescent cargo in the third color, you would be sort of happy to see that the enzymes have changed, but the cargo has stayed, right?
That's right.
So you don't even need the protein bleach.
Well, so for answering that question, all we need is just to watch it in the third color. But to ask the more detailed question about whether cargo molecules can move between comparable cisternae, that's a separate question.
You
still need it. Yeah. So. All right. How about over here? Yeah.
So I guess a question on the feedback of the cargo onto the enzymes. Mm-hmm. So the enzyme can basically do two things, right? It can either just pop into a COP1 vesicle and go somewhere else, or it can be busy modifying a protein inside.
Right.
So is there evidence for feedback?
That should be some dynamic way
of sort of having crosstalk between the systemic.
Absolutely. You should wait for Alberto's talk tomorrow, because he's actually been focusing a lot on this question of I would emphasize all of these models that we present are, you know, sort of first level simplistic models. There's almost certainly feedback in the system of the cargo that's going through. It's clear that there is, and I'm not getting into that level of interaction. Yeah.
So in the animation, I noticed that from the top left, there's these white empty vesicles that are fusing.
Yes.
But then there's also no mechanism for how the red gets, I mean, why aren't they red?
Why aren't they carrying red back?
Not that I completely understand what's going on, but I it would seem that those empty vesicles should have red in them.
Well, no, the red is here all cycling around within the system in this animation. That's membrane, so the membrane is coming back. There are also components coming back that are not diagrammed here.
So do you actually need those empty vesicles in order to...
So the whole system has to maintain a homeostatic... It has to be homeostatically maintained in terms of both the membrane and the components. It's when you start to think about it in detail, it gets kind of hairy. Yeah, so let's sort of go across. Yeah.
How do they know where to move, let's say?
This is a different talk about these targeting components. So there are questions, first of all, about how the vesicles physically get from one place to another, whether that's just Brownian diffusion, which probably is not the case in something like the cytoplasm, as opposed to some sort of, you can have cytoskeletal tracts in some cases, probably not in this case. Or you can also have agitation of the cytoplasm that allows things to move. Again, this is a rich topic of its own that, yes.
Are the transitions more discrete than you would expect them to be?
They were. So this would be a rather gradual transition. Sure. And what we saw in our movies was surprisingly abrupt. And that's one of our motivations for thinking that there may actually be discrete kinetic stages in this process, that it's not a smooth continuum, but discrete stages. And that's something we're looking at that's potentially testable by quantitative analysis of the system.
So we may put up this particular debate, which I've seen go on for much longer than one might imagine, to a journal club type scenario. In case you have a lot more things to get through.
I have more. So as you like, maybe I'll continue. And one more, yeah.
Did you try to find something like really rate limiting by trying to construct deployments and try to get half dosage into it so that you can make some testable predictions about the number of the stats or the rate at which they change.
We haven't gotten into something that sophisticated yet with this system. There's obviously a lot to learn about the mechanism of this process. We're just at the stage of saying yes, it happens, and exploring those basic aspects of the system. So,
I just had a comment that I think what you're seeing here looks also very much like what happened in an endosome.
Yes, that's right.
You know, where you change the coat or the flavor of the endosome pretty dramatically and pretty...
Very analogous to current thinking about endosomal dynamics. That's right. Yes.
Do you find also cisternae which don't change color for a long time?
So can we put a question for external color? So I'll bring wine.
Okay.
And we can do that.
The answer to that is no. We haven't seen that so far. Okay, so let me move. Okay, so this comes back to something also that was an earlier question. So what I've just shown you is a steady state model. It shows you how the Golgi can potentially maintain its operation once it already exists. The question is, how do you make a Golgi in the first place? And in some cases, you really can build a Golgi from scratch, apparently. And the cisternal maturation model, if taken to its logical extreme, can give you a potentially a plausible mechanism. So the idea is that you start with a transitional ER site, and it's producing these vesicles called COP2 vesicles. And if they coalesce, you can make a new compartment that I'm calling here a platform. And that platform could capture Golgi material recycling, say, from an existing Golgi stack somewhere else in the cell. And the net result is that you make a new cisterna. And then if that process is repeated, you make another new cisterna, and so on. And then if you turn on this recycling pathway, all of a sudden you have a fully functional secretory pathway built basically from scratch, built by self-organization. Okay, so this is, again, it's perhaps an extreme version of this perspective, but it's an intriguing idea that basically the transitional ER is the birthplace of the Golgi, and that you can give rise to new Golgi structures by this mechanism. So for this and other reasons, we've been focusing a lot on this transitional ER compartment, trying to understand how that compartment is made, that specialized domain of the ER is made. And we've been doing a lot of work in Pichia, which again has beautiful transitional ER and Golgi structure. What you're looking at here is a tomographic reconstruction of a Golgi stack in Pichia. And here's the endoplasmic reticulum at the top. This is a slice through the middle of the structure. So here's the cis, medial, trans, and TGN. The white dots are ribosomes, these protein synthesizing systems. And the Golgi stack is linked to a transitional ER site. And here's another view of that in Pichia. Here's a traditional electron micrograph of a Golgi stack, and here are ER membranes. Now, if we do this by tomography, which is a more modern version of electron microscopy that gives you 3D reconstructions, if we look down on one of these Golgi stacks, we see the trans-Golgi network here in red. If we peel that off, there's a trans, a medial, and a cis cisterna. And right underneath the cis cisterna, here in yellow, is a flat region of the ER membrane. And you see that most of the ER is covered with ribosomes. This is the so-called rough ER. But there's a ribosome-free patch of ER membrane that's engaged in producing these transport vesicles. So this is a transitional ER site. That's what they look like. And in Pichia, again, these Golgi stacks are plastered right up against transitional ER sites. So we want to know how the cell pulls that off, how it makes these transitional ER sites. And to begin to think about that, we need to look at the pathway by which those COP2 vesicles are made at the ER. And I won't go through this in any detail. This is the ER membrane. The first step is the recruitment of a small GTPase called SAR1. And that GTPase, in turn, recruits proteins that form a coat that deforms the membrane and makes a vesicle. Okay, so those coat proteins are called SEC23, 24, 13, and 31. And shown in green here is the outer shell of the coat. And we can label that coat with GFP, with green fluorescent protein, to visualize where these vesicles are forming in the yeast cells. Okay? So here's what it looks like. Here are a bunch of Saccharomyces cells, and with those glowing COP2 vesicles, you see about 30 or 40 little transitional ER sites all over the ER network. So if you remember, I showed you that Saccharomyces has a fragmented transitional ER with a lot of little transitional ER sites. In Pichia, on the other hand, we only see about 3 or 4 big transitional ER sites in each cell. So it's a much simpler, cleaner pattern. And if we now focus in on Pichia and look at it in two colors, here are transitional ER sites in green and Golgi stacks in red. And you see the same thing that we saw by electron microscopy. These compartments are linked to each other. They're functional units, the transitional ER and the Golgi. So we want to know how these transitional ER sites are made. And one way to address that question is to ask, where do new transitional ER sites come from? As the cell grows, how does it make a new transitional ER site? And we can address that again by 4D microscopy. It's a little bit bright in here to see maybe, but here's a big a mother cell and a budded cell of Pichia. And these spots are the transitional ER sites. Now, if we watch over time, this is sped up about 60-fold. Watch over here. You see a transitional ER site form seemingly out of nowhere. So this structure forms and grows larger until it reaches a steady state size. And from that point on, it's very stable. It never disappears. You watch these two, they're going to bump into each other and they fuse to make a larger structure, which gradually shrinks down over time to the steady state size. And then new ones form and so on. So with regard to dynamics, these transitional ER sites are very interesting because they're long-lived structures. They're immortal in some sense. But the number changes over time because of de novo formation, fusion, shrinkage, and so on. So based on that kind of evidence, we've proposed a self-organization model for forming these transitional ER sites within the ER membrane. And the rectangle here represents a piece of ER membrane, and the blue circles represent a hypothetical component that organizes this transitional ER domain in the membrane. And the idea is that this component is free to diffuse around, but it has a tendency to self-associate so that it can spontaneously form clusters, patches, in the membrane. That would be a de novo formation event. These patches would then grow by capturing additional components, and if two of these self-associating patches bump into each other, they will naturally fuse into a larger structure. Okay, so this kind of model can explain the de novo formation and the fusion of transitional ER sites. Yes?
Do you say before that when they fused, it shrank to the size of one?
It does eventually shrink, yes. Okay. So that's the next point, because this model doesn't explain that. Right? According to this model, they would just eventually glom together into one big structure. So why would they shrink? To explain shrinkage, we invoke the COP2 vesicles that bud out of these domains. So if those vesicles carry away some of the organizing component, that will tend to shrink the transitional ER site. Okay, so we have a balance between growth, which occurs by capture here at the periphery, and shrinkage, which occurs by vesicle budding from within the area of the compartment. And if the vesicle budding rate goes as the area, as r squared, and the growth goes as the circumference, linearly as r, then there will be some radius where there will be a steady state, where the two processes will balance, and you'll have a stable size of the transitional ER site. Okay, so that's as close as we come to doing physics. That's our model. Okay, yes.
There are two models, of course, that one can probably differentiate here. One is purely self-assembly mm-hmm. of different components that come together and form exit sites. And the other one is that there might be a template, which you don't visualize here, of course.
Right.
It's not labeled, so you don't see it. So I don't think that these images allow actually to distinguish between the two. In fact, the fact that the final size of the assembly remains the same speaks more in favor of the idea that there is a fixed size template that's there and it's filled, or maybe it's also emptied under certain circumstances.
Well, I think that's correct from what I've shown you. We have mutants that, as you'll see in a minute, where the size changes and where we can control those changes in size, which speaks more to the dynamic model. I think that there are organisms that do have a template where they just have one or two transitional ER sites in a fixed location. So I think the cell can do what you're talking about. I'm not sure it happens in this system. So, yeah, there were other questions. Yes.
But you sort of could interrogate the dynamics by doing FRAP again and maybe overexpressing so various components of this thing and see that if there's a higher concentration of these stuff in the ER, you get bigger or sort of more numerous of these.
That's right. And by frap, you do see that these components are exchanging in and out. Even though the structure is stable, the individual components are moving in and out quite rapidly.
But you would sort of, well, I guess the resolution probably isn't sufficient to see them like moving inward. And sort of
that's right.
The whole.
We can't see the individual components. Yeah.
So going back to the question of the self-organization or whatever, nucleation of new Golgi stack. So one of the questions is, why is it a pancake? So by fusing vesicles, you just think you make a bigger vesicle. So at some point, a week or two ago, somebody was telling us that there is some protein in the Golgi, I believe, which sort of favors, or at least that's the interpretation, high local curvature and assembles into kind of a filament, which we can mark the perimeter. Am I making things up?
Reticulons in the ER.
Okay, so
but to the extent that it's the same membrane.
Well, if you fuse a bunch of little spheres together, you don't have the same surface to volume ratios in a big sphere. Right, so that's one argument for the flattened structure.
So you, you think that it's just controlled by surface to volume ratio?
There are also osmotic mechanisms that seem to be involved in
that. That would be the same. They would just control surface to volume. So are there these what do we call the reticulons?
There are some reticulon structured proteins. IPS3 is it? Some IPS and Ceruvisia. Yeah. If you look carefully at the structure, the basic structure, it looks remarkably like reticulon. So they might actually
reticulon.
And they definitely localize to the reticulon.
Reticulon favors tubes, not pancakes. So.
Right.
But in a way, I quite argue that you don't need maybe it's some modification of a basic curvature favoring.
It's curvature only at the rims, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. It's very high permission.
I think a better model is this protein called perforin RDS, which is in the retinal pancake structures. It favors and is localized in the rim, only in the rim, not in the flat section. Because you don't need any protein to make a flat membrane. It's favorable. So.
I think there are probably, it's not really well understood. And you could also imagine proteins that would link within the lumen that would help to contribute to this structure. I think there's not much evidence for that. But
that's how perforin is believed to work.
Within the lumen.
I'm asking the question now is to the extent that one thinks of TR as a factory for making these Golgi cisternae, then whatever those other scaffold proteins that are required to make pancakes would somehow have to fit.
So some of these components are actually in the cytosol and assemble under the surface of membranes. We've been talking about proteins that live in the membranes, but a lot of them are peripherally associated and cycling on and off.
How flat is it? Is it about the size of these?
Well, so it's these transitional ER sites tend to be in flat regions. So here's an image of it. This is really quite a flat cisternal region that's giving rise to that structure, and that seems to be the trend.
Is there any evidence that these are tubules rather than the vesicles?
That which are tubules?
The copper tube.
There's a lot of discussion about that, and I think the answer is probably, at least in mammalian cells.
The EM can be interpreted as the cross. The tubule, but if you
sure.
back of the tubule, you're going to get, if you purify the tubules, you're going to get the vesicles.
Well, this with the tomographic reconstructions, you can really distinguish between those two. And at least in the Pichia system, they're clearly little round vesicles. Mm-hmm. But there is evidence, again, some of it from Alberto's work, that COP2 can maybe form more complex structures to be involved in.
The holes that, if you go through your Z-stack that you had there, the holes that you saw, are those tubes connected? Or are those actually just holes?
No, these are holes through the structure, and that's
what a tube would look like.
Well, it's not. There are a lot of very interesting questions here. So notice that there are no holes on the cis side, and the next one has a bunch around the edges. So how do you make a hole all of a sudden? This question has arisen, and my personal favorite idea is that you have a disc and a tube snakes out and fuses back with the same structure, and topologically that's then that's then one of these openings. And we notice them early in the Golgi, typically around the rims, which is where they would form in that model. And they seem to migrate inward as the cisternae get older. Just a speculation, but it's not understood why they form, really how they form.
But are there water channels in the Golgi?
Water channels, you mean like aquaporin type channels? I don't know about that. There are proteins that help to maintain the osmolarity and the pH of the Golgi that are probably involved in the structural organization as well.
I think there are components in the Golgi, but in any case, membranes are permeable to water. And so I think without the control of the ionic composition, osmolarity, as well as types of ions, I think there will be no control on this shape, pancake type shape.
Yes.
So there is, in fact, there is a toxin, melanocin, which I think it's a proton channel, and in the presence of this toxin system as well.
Okay. So I'm going to go through this quickly, but just, and this sort of gets at the question about whether about this testing this model for the formation of transitional ER sites. Here's a Pichia strain that has fluorescently tagged transitional ER sites, 3 or 4 per cell on average. We identified a mutant that looks more like Saccharomyces. It has a lot of little transitional ER sites instead of a few big ones. And that mutation lies in a gene called SEC16. SEC stands for secretory pathway. And it's a point mutation here in a central conserved domain of SEC16. Now, SEC16 is known to be a peripheral ER membrane protein that interacts with components of these COP2 vesicles. So it was interesting that a mutation in this gene, but otherwise the protein is of unknown function. It was interesting to us that mutation affected transitional ER sites. Just to show you quickly, here's SEC16 in Pichia, and here's a COP2 component, so they perfectly co-localize. SEC16 is at transitional ER sites. But it's quantitatively about an order of magnitude less abundant than SEC13, which is a component of that COP2 code. So it looks like it's maybe a regulator rather than a stoichiometric component of the COP2 code protomer. And we've been trying to understand what SEC16 does, and I'm just going to skip through all of the data and show you our current conclusion. And that is, we think that SEC16 is a regulator of the budding rate of COP2 vesicles, and it can have both positive and negative regulatory effects. So it can stimulate vesicle budding or it can inhibit the vesicle budding. And we think that the point mutation that we identified selectively blocks the inhibitory regulatory effect of SEC16. So as a result, we just have the stimulatory effect, and the mutant SEC16 is hyperactive. Yes?
So what does the negative or positive effect of SEC16 on biting depend on?
What does it
in the context of other proteins present?
We don't know that. So we're just we're really at an early stage of figuring this out. We're sort of at the level of molecular description, I guess, rather than a detailed mechanistic understanding. But this general model fits with what we've seen so far. Yeah.
Is SEC16 dynamic at the PKN, PKN,
is it moving in and out? Yes, it is. So it's like most components. It's quite dynamic. So again, I'm skipping over almost all of the data. I'll just show you one of the more interesting pieces. So again, we have this mutant that has more transitional ER sites. And our idea is this mutant has hyperactivated vesicle budding. So how can we put that together? Well, coming back for our model, our self-organization model for transitional ER sites, again, we have a balance between shrinkage, which is mediated by vesicle budding, and growth, which is mediated by capture. If we turn up the vesicle budding rate, we should accelerate shrinkage selectively without accelerating growth. So basically, transitional ER sites should shrink much faster than in wild type. We should see faster dynamics. And we can test, so then the prediction is, if you look at shrinkage in the mutant, it should be faster than in wild type cells. We can test that by making videos. So here's the mutant Pichia strain with labeled transitional ER sites, and you can see that things have just gone crazy. We call this movie Spots Gone Wild in my lab, right? So compared to that, those gradual changes that you saw in the wild type, all of the dynamics are much faster. And we can go in and quantify shrinkage rates. So the half-time for shrinkage of a fused transitional ER site in wild-type cells is around 10 minutes, and it's about 30 seconds in a mutant cell. So it's a very dramatic change in the dynamics. And this gets back to Alberto's question. We think by changing one of the kinetic parameters, we've dramatically altered the size of these structures, which says, at least in this system, that the dynamics are the major determining factor.
Yes. The cells are happy?
The cells are, they're not so happy at the restrictive temperature, but they survive reasonably well, which may not be surprising because Saccharomyces looks like this and is a very happy beast.
But it has sort of a bunch, couple of million, hundreds of million years to sort
that's
of
true.
Hear different things.
That's true, yes.
How do you measure the half-times? Do you fit to an exponential?
Well, we don't really fit it. We just trace it and draw the line at 50%. So it's a crude measure, yeah.
You might have mentioned this, I missed it. This mutation in Pikia, it looks like something that already exists in Cerebus.
It's not that simple, no. So we don't, there's a lot of difference, even though the yeasts are closely related, there's a lot of divergence in the proteins, and we don't know at that level exactly what's different. But this led us to wonder, could we do it the other way around? Could we slow down ER export in Saccharomyces and cause the transitional ER sites to get bigger and fatter? And the answer is yes. So here's a mutant that's blocked in ER export. Here it is at the permissive temperature when it's behaving normally, a lot of little spots. And at the non-permissive temperature, now it looks a little bit more like Pichia. We get a lot of coalescence into these big transitional ER sites.
Use the organized collagen stacks?
I'll come to that in just a sec. So we can do this same experiment, it turns out, in a simpler way, just by washing the cells into medium that lacks glucose. You take away their food, and the secretory pathway freezes, and you get the same thing. You get this coalescence, and you get bigger transitional ER sites. And when we did that trick, we saw something that we had never seen before in Saccharomyces. So Saccharomyces is hard to analyze by fluorescence microscopy because you just have a lot of little spots all over the place. Now that we have a simpler pattern, we notice that the transitional ER sites, which are here in blue, are often right next to the early Golgi structures, which are shown here in yellow. There's a very clear association of transitional ER with cis-Golgi. The later Golgi is still separate. It's still floating off on its own. So we don't get Golgi stacks, but we see a transitional ER to cis-Golgi association. So coming back to this old picture of the picture that I showed you before of Pichia, it turns out that Saccharomyces and Pichia are not as different as they originally seemed. So here in Pichia, the transitional ER is linked tightly to the cis-Golgi. That happens too in Saccharomyces, apparently. The difference between them is that Pichia also is stacking the rest of the Golgi cisternae into this structure, and that doesn't happen in Saccharomyces. So our inference from this is that a transitional ER Golgi association may be a widespread or possibly universal property of the secretory pathway. But stacking of the Golgi may be an optional property, quote unquote. That's a little bit heretical in the field because when people are asked to define the Golgi, most of them would say it's a stack of flattened membranes. And our view is that maybe that's not so fundamental. And there's reason to think to support this idea that cisternal stacking is optional in some way. This is an inferred evolutionary diagram from a review by Joel Dax, where they've looked at Golgi stacking in various eukaryotic lineages. So their interpretation is that the ancestral eukaryote has had a stacked Golgi, but that Golgi stacking has been lost a number of times in evolution. So over here are Saccharomyces and Pichia, with Saccharomyces having lost Golgi stacking. But it's happened a bunch of times in very different eukaryotic lineages, suggesting that while Golgi stacking is obviously doing something for the cell, that you can probably get rid of it without perturbing the fundamental mechanism of how the Golgi works.
Anything they have in common?
No.
There's plasmodium and there's chargia.
It's very hard to say why. I mean, these are very diverse organisms in the eukaryotic lineage. So our view of this is that the non-stacked Golgi and Saccharomyces is probably a viable system for studying Golgi dynamics. That's not a universal view. I would say that of this this work that Aki Nakano's lab and my lab published, the major response, typically from people who work only in mammalian cells, I have to say, has been that's how it works in yeast, but mammals may be different. And that response really surprised me. This is me being astonished. So, and that's because, so I'm going to be a little bit defensive here in arguing in support of the Saccharomyces data as something that we can generalize. But this is the argument I'm trying to put forth. So those yeast experiments that where we tested this cisternal maturation model were inspired by data from algae and Alberto's data from mammalian cells, and they really only made sense in light of data from other organisms. We would never have conceived those experiments if it hadn't been for those other results favoring cisternal maturation. And again, our take on it is that there are these conserved cell biological mechanisms, and that the basic operation of the Golgi probably falls into this category.
So couldn't you do the same mutations with the mammalian cells?
We could. So in coming years with super resolution imaging, it may be possible to do the same kinds of experiments in a stacked Golgi. And that will really address this issue. So far, we're still some years away from being able to realize that. One of the major problems that people who work in other systems have is the question of whether Golgi stacking is dynamic. So in the cisternal maturation model, this glue that holds the Golgi together has to fall apart at the trans side, because as the cisterna matures, it eventually has to peel away and disappear. So you have to postulate that glue, whatever it is reversible. And I think that's not so far-fetched, because it looks like that's what happens. This is from a plant cell. This is a Golgi stack, and you see these Golgi cisternae with they're very swollen with the secretory cargo. But it looks as if at the trans side of the Golgi, these cisternae are peeling off and turning into secretory vesicles that fuse with the plasma membrane. And there are similar images. They're just static images, but there are similar images from many other cell types suggesting that at the trans side of the Golgi, this glue dissolves and the cisternae fall off. So, and I'd just like to finish up by saying I think people who have argued in this field that certain cell types, that the Golgi operates differently in certain cell types, that those arguments have not stood the test of time. So, for example, this observation that in algae big things move through the Golgi has been known for many years. And it was when the stable compartments model was dominant, this observation was sort of relegated to footnotes. So I've blown up one of these footnotes from a prominent review in 1981. It says the only case where a cis-trans movement of cisternae seems to be established is that of algae. But this may represent a rare formula with the unusual geometry of this product. I think in hindsight, that's not the right way to look at it. Mammalian cells do it the same way. And that for the most part, with these fundamental mechanisms, they are conserved across cell types. So again, my view is I tend to embrace the unity of life and think that the basic mechanisms that operate within the Golgi are conserved regardless of whether the cisternae are stacked. So, in conclusion, the transitional ER and Golgi are intimately associated, and that's probably a conserved association. And we think that self-organization models are a useful way to think about the formation of secretory compartments, transitional ER and Golgi structures, and also their dynamics. There are many things that are unknown in this field, and one of them is that the link between the structure of the Golgi and its function is still not well understood, as we've discussed a bit. So, for example, why is the Golgi divided into cisternae, as we've discussed? Why do some cells have so many of them? I count 17 in this Golgi stack. It's not clear why that has to be. How is the number of cisternae regulated? What is it that glues them together? And again, how does this glue dissolve at the level of the trans-Golgi network? And what is it that defines these compartments of the Golgi, or these different stages of basically the polarity of the Golgi stack? So I'll just stop there. These are people in my lab who have contributed, and collaborators who have contributed to this work. And I'll thank Professor Golgi for getting us all started.
So, yeah. Amazing.
So,